Everyone, welcome back to Looks Like Work. I'm your host, Chedva Kleinler, and I'm so excited just welcoming you to Looks Like Work because this is just our second episode in our second season after a very long break of over a year. Yeah, it's been a while. So on today's episode, we have a super deep and spiritual conversation with Yakir and Lindell, whom I'm proud and humbled and privileged to have known for 30 years, and we'll delve into what that means and how that came about. On our episode, we'll talk about very complex, I think, notions and concepts, from spirituality to faith to living in a state of war. We'll also delve a little bit into that 30 minutes into the conversation. I wanted to preface this episode because this is really, I've been so privileged during, you know, the over 20 episodes of Looks Like Work to have such meaningful and deep conversations. But this one really rings special, and I wanted to kind of bring your attention to it. It's definitely more on the spiritual side. We talk a lot about the place of faith and of community and of holding different, complex, and many times complicated truth at the same time, and being able to have them not just coexist, but actually create something beautiful out of the gaps between them and create a new life, create a new way of living and an approach and an attitude that could also help us see other people and be there for them. So I really hope you'll kind of be there with us for this episode. And I really, really, really cannot wait to hear what you've thought and what you felt listening to it. Yakir is such a special person, and it's been my utter privilege to learn with him and from him during this conversation. And with that, without further ado, I guess, let's get to my conversation with Yakir. I hope you'll enjoy it and learn something from it. So where should we start?
So happy to be here, and I absolutely love all these conversations that you're having. They're so aligned with how I think these days.
Even 2 hours.
I hope speakers of English as a second language communicate confidently and joyfully.
I think this is what I wanted to do. And I suddenly
see your life shift, you start to feel your life shift. And that's when your vibration changes and you feel confident and empowered on the next phase of your
life. So what looks like work for you? Yakir Englander.
Hey, good
Welcome
to be here.
Welcome to Looks Like Work. I'm so excited. So before I introduce Yakir, Yakir and I have known each other for over 30 years, if you can imagine that. I know I look very young, but still. And we're kind of family or extended family. And I'm really, really excited to have you here, Yakir, because I've been following your journey online for the last decade or more. And I'm so inspired by so many of the stuff you do. And honestly, I also am really curious to hear more about the things you do, but also what you feel and how you decide what to do and what led you there and what leads you where you're going. So before we continue, let me quickly introduce you. Yakir is the Senior Director of Leadership at the Israeli American Council, also known as IAC. He's also a lecturer at the Rabbinical School HAR in New York and a Fulbright Scholar, and also a really, really inspiring guy. Thank you so much for coming here, Yakir.
Thank you so much, Chedvi, for having me. And I think it's interesting because you said that we know each other for 30 years, which is true. But I'm also thinking, like, both of us, we have a Jewish, ultra-Orthodox, very religious background. So in a way, I knew you, but I mostly knew about you. I don't feel that we ever spoke. We have this intimacy that we're going to have now of speaking, taking time to know each other and to explore life together. It's something that we don't do between gender in the ultra-Orthodox world, unless it's like your sister or your mother or your partner. So I just feel that, yeah, there is element of almost a sin that, like, I don't have it because, you know, I'm so many years outside of the community, but I'm thinking like, wow, I never did it. Like, it's a question that walk with me. It's one of the reasons why I decided to leave the community with a lot of love, but I felt that there is a whole world of women. I'm much more interested in femininity in general in life. So masculinity is a question that I'm struggle. I love it. When people ask me, what is your pronouns? So I say, this is my first incarnation that I am he, him. So I take responsibility as a cis man, but also I'm not sure that I know exactly what to do with that. So I think like having the gift to speak with someone who grew up in the ultra-Orthodox world is not something that like, oh, we know each other for 30 years and let's chat again. It's like, we never chat before in a serious way. So I'm honored and thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you so much for being here. And you know, you got me thinking because it is true. I think with us also, you know, we were both kids, but we were different stages of childhood. And when you're a kid, even like 2 or 3 years makes such a vast difference. And you're like, I'm not going to talk with someone who's like 2 or 3 or 4 years older than me. Like, so we really did not have that opportunity. And thinking about what you said, it's so true, because I often say, you know, as a ultra-Orthodox woman in the workforce or a woman from an ultra-Orthodox background, who knows, I often see people from our community interacting with the opposite gender at work from, like, more easily if it's an ultra-Orthodox man interacting with a secular woman, or if it's an ultra-Orthodox woman interacting with a secular man, while you put like two ultra-Orthodox people from the opposite genders in the same meeting, and somehow it's more awkward. And it shouldn't be like, we both come from the same, you know, community, from the same home, from the same cultural context and references. And it's just weird, right?
I mean, because of that, because part of our teaching that we have as ultra-Orthodox is that we should not talk with each other, and that I have nothing to do as a man to learn from women because your world is so different. And I also think that the one thing that we as men, we are dedicating most of our time, or at least we should, which is the ideal, which is the text that called the Talmud or the Gemara, which is the texts that were edited around the time of between 100 BC to 500. So it's like a lot of the time of like Jesus, you know, all the students and everyone. This is the only text that you women are not allowed to study.
Yeah, and there's a whole thing around it. It's like very, very charged.
Exactly. So the thing that we are studying the most, and it's like the ideal thing to be in a relationship, you are not allowed to have. So, I mean, these are a lot of questions of gender, and I can dive into. I mean, this is my PhD about, I mean, not about this subject, but about like question of gender and religion. And my books are about, but yeah, let's first.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. And I think, you know, this brings me to the wider kind of context of this season and definitely this episode. Last season, we talked a lot about, of course, the intersection of life and work, but we dived very deep into burnout and into choices and into work-life balance or the myth thereof. And this season, one of the things that I'm most excited to explore is the question of identity and of purpose and where it meets us both when it comes to work, but also when it comes to life, because we all know, like, I think maybe it was the outliers a few years ago before COVID who said like we should discuss how like work and life are like they intersect. We have, you know, you can't have one without the other, or you at least can't have work without the life, you know. Now I feel like it's almost mainstream. And for me, since I'm dealing with a lot of those questions recently in my life and my career, it's just an opportunity to ask very smart people that I respect a lot of questions and process my thoughts and feelings through all of you. And recently I listened to a few of your podcast interviews, Yekia, and I loved how, you know, what I always, but especially now, say, I really, really, really admire people who can hold a few different truths maybe even a few truths that can seem to contradict each other, and live peacefully with them, embrace them, and make something beautiful, not only from those multiple beliefs and value systems, but actually from the gaps or from the delta or from the kind of pressure or tension between them. I would love to hear, how does that speak to you? Like, what do you feel about it?
Wow, this is the essence of my life. So if you ask the question of like, why I do what I do, what is the energy, what the purpose of my journey? So I grew up in a religious family, and for sure it shaped me deeply. And I'm so thankful in a way for life that chose me for that. Also, I'm very thankful to myself in my 22 years old version, who has the courage with no words to say it's not for me, or I cannot do that, in, at least inside the community. And the only way for me, in order not to spiritually commit suicide, is to live. And again, to live with a lot of love. It's a big difference. I'm not an atheist. It's not that I'm saying, God, from now on, I don't care about you. My main question and my main reason to live, my two main reasons to live, were one, gender. I just didn't feel that I fit. And we, if you want, we can later speak about that. And second, my relationship with the divine. So when you ask what is my purpose in life, is to take my relationship with the divine, the one that I had, and to try to hold this covenant, this relationship at the center, and then to ask, what is this relationship? Seriously, what is this relationship? And I don't want to go to any verse from the Bible, from the New Testament, from the Quran, or from the, you know, different Buddhist traditions. I want to stay with the question. This is the purpose of my life, is to stay with the question. And when you stay mostly silent with the question of what is your relationship with the divine, the questions start changing. Because the divine of your childhood is not the divine, hopefully, of your adulthood. And there is not one answer. So slowly the divine became not the divine, not God, that I knew as a child or as a teenager or as a student in the religious school, in the yeshiva. And slowly this God died. It's not that like there is no God. It's like, it's not the God that I grow up with. Now, people can say, oh, you want to rebel? It's not about wanting to rebel. It's not about want to do anything, actually. It's just sitting gently with a lot of the sources that I grow up with, a lot of my ancestors, my physical ancestors, and my spiritual ancestors, those creatures that I grow up in the books about, and to invite them. I remember vividly, Chedvi, when I start learning about Christianity. And again, not as a big deal, not because I wanted to become a Catholic, but I needed to understand what the intimacy that Christian, Catholic, they have with the divine. So I sat, and I'm still going very proudly when I came to Catholic monasteries. And I'm sitting on Friday night, which is the holy night of the Jewish people, when, you know, your family, my family, both families sitting, singing together, praying together, Shabbat. And I'm sitting and I need to do Shabbat. I cannot do it when I had dinner with the monks because none of us spoke. But then I'm back in my room and there is a huge cross and I need to sit there. And I need to do my Shabbat. I want to do my Shabbat. And I'm sitting there and I'm saying, like, we have so many stories, so many traumatic stories, right? So think about that. All the stories.
All the stories we grew up on.
Exactly. In Eastern Europe, of these Jews who were forced to convert to Christianity, etc.
The Inquisition. Like,
exactly. And here I am in the 21st century, choosing to be in a monastery, and I'm like, Yakir, you are a traitor, not only of your family today, of your ancestors, but I know that I'm not. Everyone changed. We change. We have now sovereignty. It's called the State of Israel. Anti-Semitism is changing. There is still problems, but it's changing. The Catholic Church hugely changed. There is not one big Catholic Church. There is not one ultra-Orthodox. There are many different.
Yeah, it's not the empire anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm sitting there and I'm deciding, and you can say that I'm a weirdo. I cannot care what people will say. I'm deciding to have my Shabbat singing together and to invite my ancestors, my spiritual ancestors, all these rabbis, and that I have deep intimate relationship with, and to invite them. Now, I don't care if you ask me if objectively they listen to me or not, or I cannot care about reality as it is.
In your heart, they did.
Exactly. Because this is my life. And I'm sitting there and I'm singing the songs and I'm inviting my ancestors, and I really feel that they are afraid to come. And I promise them, I know you don't have agency because you are Jews who were beaten by this anti-Semitic, but your child, your grandchild, Yakir, serving the military, I know martial arts. I love martial arts. I invite you and I promise you that at least for now, you will be in this room safe. Would you like to meet Christianity? And I'm tearing and praying. And again, all what I do is to listen. So I'm very active, but I'm also very, in a way, really gently and listening.
You're kind of facilitating.
And I'm facilitating myself, first of all. And I'm facilitating intergenerational trauma. And by the way, any listener here of this podcast, we know what is intergenerational trauma. It can be sexual trauma. It can be alcohol trauma, substances, etc. And I'm sitting there and this is my healing. And I think when you ask me about like why I do what I do exactly that. I love to be very open to life and to choose things that look contradict to each other, and to invite myself and the people, or they invite me, to come and sit with them in many different ways, and to be with the intimacy of life. And then when people ask me, but it's contradicted, Azar, it's like you are or here or there. I worked for 14 years, right, with Palestinians in Jerusalem. People tell me you don't love the Israelis. I'm like, if this is the way how you look on things, so I understand you, but I will never go to meet with Palestinians on the account of the Israelis. I go to meet with the Palestinians because life, you can call it God, you can call it whatever, choose that the state of Israel was built in a place where Palestinians have been for hundreds of years. Now, we can debate about it. I don't care. In their narrative, they have been there for hundreds of years. They care about the place. So you can say, oh my God, I have enemies. Or you can say, wow, life, God, choose me to be with them. By the way, it's not Yakir. I'm quoting now the first Zionist Orthodox rabbi, Rabbi Cook. He said in his book, Orot, life chose us to be next to the Arabs. It means that there is a common learning between us. And what I try to do is to invite that.
I love it. I love it in this specific case that you mentioned, but also, you know, that feeling of inviting your ancestors. You probably can identify, let me know if you can or not, but in my family, ancestry is a very big thing. Ichus, you know, who we come from. We shouldn't be the ones to kind of snip the chain of generations. We don't want to be the shame of our ancestors. We want to, you know, facilitate maybe like what they brought into the world, into our generation. It's a very, very, very big thing. And I'm sure, by the way, speaking of gender, I'm sure it is different for men and women. And maybe men get like the more active part and women get like a lot of the maintenance part.
100%.
And, you know, I have always had a very tricky relationship with that, because on the one hand, I think this is, as someone who's very much a family person,
there is so much love in it. There is so much emotion in it. There is so much beauty, right? And those, like, in being another link in this chain. There's also a lot of pressure and shame. My son says sometimes that tradition is being peer pressured by people who are not living anymore. So there's a lot of that too. And when I look at faith, and by the way, when I look at other choices in life too, I really relate to what you said about being with the, actually, I don't know if you said it or I'm kind of paraphrasing you, being with the feeling of the thing rather than the thing itself. Like when I look at faith, I'm not necessarily looking at every law out of the over 600 commandments. I'm looking at the feeling that I have listening to stories of, you know, early Hasidut rabbis, right? I think about, or I feel the stories about my ancestors. I feel, you know, the memories that I have from my late grandmother. And I can tell you that during COVID, it was like a very difficult time for everyone. I was just recovering from a very long steroid treatment. So my immune system was basically non-existent. It was pretty scary. Very quickly realized that I would have to shut down my startup that I worked on for 5 years with amazing people and with investors who trusted us with their money and clients and all of that. And I found myself doing something that I never would imagine myself doing, yoga. Like really, if you told me that I'd do yoga, I would laugh in your face, because it always felt to me like something so inactive and boring and, you know, all those cliches. But I found myself doing yoga, and while I was practicing yoga, you know, there's like the meditation part, no matter how minuscule it is and no matter how like short it is, but still you have to be with yourself. And it really, really, really reminded me of prayer, of Jewish prayer. And you know, in Jewish prayer, we have our texts that you say every day. You know, sometimes you have a few differences, but you have like those same, the morning prayer, the afternoon prayer, the evening prayer. And it's very challenging sometimes to say the same prayer, do the same yoga positions, right? And still be with it and not like let your mind wander. And there's a lot of shame about like not fully being there, not putting emotion and intention into every single word. And when the yoga instructor, who wasn't even there, she was on a YouTube video, and she said, it's okay if your mind wanders, I was like, this is the most Jewish thing and the least Jewish thing I have ever heard. And that for me connected to my experience of being Hasidic. While if it's, you know, practically, if it's related to any religion, then it's probably Buddhism or something like that, right? So I really, really love just the notion of like thinking with your feelings, basically, and seeing what connects rather than what like the logic of the, you know, what shelf it is in the library.
Right. So yeah, I mean, you said so many fascinating things, and I just want to focus on one of them because I want to challenge you. So one of the challenges, and again, I'm dealing with that on, believe me, like for many years. I mean, I think that I have a solution for myself, but it's a question that I'm asking. And again, I speak about the religious Orthodox Jewish tradition. Okay, I'm very careful. Is that at the end of the day, your feelings are very welcome. And I judge you at the end of the day by your action. This is a decision, right? This is a decision of the tradition where you and me, we grow up with. Some other people who are listening here, so I want to be very gentle about that. They grew up, let's say, Catholic. So for them, it will be a different thing. It will not be about the action, but it will be about some maybe elements of faith or way of believing, right? Around LGBTQ as an example.
Or even non-Orthodox Jews who like practice.
Non-Orthodox Jews, it's different because, and I will tell you why, because I don't think that their Jewish identity based at the end of the day on action.
Yeah.
right? The Orthodoxy decided, and again, I don't say it was historically like that always, but at least today, where we grow up, you are judged at the end of the day by your action. Do you keep Shabbat? I don't care what you think about Shabbat. I don't care what you believe in God. No one cares about that. By the way, no one is going to ask you about that. But do you keep kosher, or do you keep Shabbat, or do you keep purity, or anything that I'm going to say, according to the law that we decided that this is the law? Now, this is at the end of the day's story, if you are going to be in or out. This is about that. Now you can be an hipster Orthodox, but at the end of the day, you are keeping the kosher in the way that we understand kosher, right? We are keeping Shabbat in a way that you cannot go, if you are Orthodox, you cannot go to be in nature unless you really prepare it in ways that will be too ridiculous.
You can't drive. Yeah.
You cannot drive, you cannot go. There is a question about, like, can you go to swim in the ocean? I will not go there. How much you can go in nature? I will not go there. At the end of the day, if you want to be in, you need to circumcise your kid. Okay, let's go to the main, to the first call. Yeah. I have a kid now, 8 weeks old. This was a question. Is he going to be circumcised or he's not going to be circumcised? I think it's very important because not always you have the agency to really be flexible. And I think that many of your audience who are listening now, it's important for me that I will give them the voice around that.
That is such an important, that is a super important sentence that he just said. Yeah.
And I have friends, one of my best friend, she is, she grew up Catholic. And she is very much into social justice. She is from LGBTQ. At the end of the day, there is a contradiction. I know nuns who are fighting for LGBTQ, but at the end of the day, they cannot be priests. Okay? And I don't want to run away and to say, but it's about the feeling. Yes, it's about your feeling, but at the end of the day, you need to have the courage to decide if you want to make change, how you're going to do it.
So important
from inside, and this is very important. Yeshaya Berlin, who was a Jewish philosopher, I mean, he was a philosopher, he was also Jewish. He said that there are two kind of people who do critique, and we need to make a separation between each one because they have different roles. One is a person who does a critique from inside. Okay, so you think like Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr. Right? These holy people, they did the change inside India, inside the Black community and the white community of America. Then you have people who said, I can't breathe anymore. I just can't breathe. I must live with love, with pain, with trauma, and I will do change in different ways. Each one has a role. Each one is important.
So now I want to challenge you.
Please.
Because you brought up a super, super, super important sentence before, saying basically we're privileged to have this conversation, right? And I really, really relate to that because I feel in my experience, I've been extremely privileged and I have been able in my life and in my career kind of being to be the bridge in many ways, and to criticize and also change things, hopefully, maybe a little bit from the inside, while not paying all the prices for that, right? Like when I was one of the first ultra-Orthodox entrepreneurs and a woman on top of that, I was very worried that I would face a lot of criticism from the inside. And I was actually able to do that, to also criticize and help things within the community, help people from outside the community see that it's a possibility and kind of challenge them and say, like, how are you helping that? And still, when I was in the magazine, in the paper, which is very, very, very uncommon, right?
For sure.
And I would go to shul, to synagogue for the high holidays and didn't know how people would react. They would come to me and say, wow, this was a big Kiddush Hashem. You actually like really helped us with our positioning in the world.
You brought the beauty of our community to the outside, right?
Exactly, exactly. And that isn't the way it must have been. And part of the privilege is being in a more modern, while ultra-Orthodox family and community. Part of it has been like doing things in a very diplomatic way in hindsight and kind of towing the line and being able to criticize, but also do it in a very loving way and in a very kind of polite way and kind of balance between activism and still being part of the community. Part of it was being part of a very strong family in the community and part of a marriage and stuff like that. And I see this year, when part of those things have been gone, I'm suddenly paying a lot of prices that I haven't before. And I'm sure other people, especially if they're marginalized in other ways as well, inside the ultra-Orthodox community, I'm sure people from other communities can also relate. They probably pay much larger prices than I'm paying even now. So when you talk about the people criticizing or making change from the inside and the outside, I couldn't agree more. But you mentioned a choice of staying inside and a choice of, I can't breathe anymore. I need to do it from the outside. I can't stay in this community. But I also want to bring up that those choices are also a little bit privileged, because then you have the people who were kind of pushed out. Because part of what you said about actions, I feel in our community, but also in other communities, I remember I translated a book by John Grogan, who grew up in a very Catholic family, and I related to so much of what he said. So part of growing up in a very closed community is that it's not only your actions, it's also how it looks like.
100%. I mean, 100%. And it's very important points what you bring. This is a lot of my work. A lot of my work is to try to help people who feel that they don't have agency, is to see a few things. One, yes, not always we have agency. Like really, if you grow up gay and you are a gay person and you are growing up inside the Catholic tradition, or I will speak about the Orthodox tradition because I prefer to critique myself and not other traditions, or even to grow up gay inside a Buddhist tradition, a non-Western Buddhist tradition, you're going to face a lot of challenges. And at one point, there is a chance that you will be kicked out. And I think that this, not always we have choice. I didn't want to leave the community. Now, I can say the community kicked me out because I choose to leave the institute and to join the military. I had a breakup. I was engaged when I was inside, and I decided to leave, or she decided to, it doesn't matter. We decided it was a whole mess. So we are creating messiness. I mean, you can be gay and you can be totally shut up, like totally, like be quiet and not share what you feel inside. I think that this is death. So it's very important for me when I work with people who grew up, our example is religion now, to help them to see the places where actually they had agency, they have power, because I think it's very important also for themselves. I mean, first of all, for themselves. So the narratives that they will have will not focus only on I was kicked out, but to the opposite. It's like, I choose some action, which slowly I'm going to learn to be proud of. For example, let's say I'm gay. And instead of being embarrassed by my identity, I'm going to embrace my identity. Maybe I'm going to be kicked out. I don't want to be kicked out, but I grew up, let's say, in some Muslim tradition. I'm going to be kicked out and I can hold it. And then what is important for me, and this is my life journey, is to sit with this intimacy, not to try to solve it. When people ask me, what do I need to do now? I left my community, or I was kicked out, as you said. Let's sit. Let's sit together. There is a lot of grief to do. There is a lot of narrative to change. And slowly, I want you to see how you actually can choose what kind of relationships, not one, ships, you want to have with your past? Is it going to be a narrative of, I had no choice and I was kicked out? Like, think about our grandparents who survived the Holocaust. Most of the narrative, and I totally understand it, is they just hated us, killed us, and this is the end of the story. But when I think about that, this generation created the state of Israel. They also had agency to say, we were killed, our family were burned and gassed in Auschwitz and Treblinka, and we choose, instead of leaving, try to kill back Nazis all our life, is to take this energy, like in martial arts, to take the energy, and instead of now fighting back, they decided to create this country that called Israel, which is a miracle in a way, with the amount of post-trauma.
Totally.
Right? So this is where I want to be in life in general, with this intimacy of what happened when I sit with the trauma and I try to see how life can help me to heal it.
I love this because also I think in life as humans, we rush so much to solve things and to make things make sense, right?
Right.
And it's actually a lot of times the things that don't make sense that make us who we are. And also that's where a lot of creativity comes and a lot of invention comes from and humanity. So right. I love that.
And what is important just to say is to help people. And this is where my work is, to make sure that I can help people in that moment or communities in that moment by also connecting them to the right teachers. I see myself as a connector in many ways, because we are not alone in this trauma, right? Whatever it is, I can tell you a teacher, we can find together a teacher or two that can inspire you in these moments and help you to walk from there.
Which is amazing. So can you tell us a little bit more about this work and how does it look like in practice?
Yes, for sure. So it looks very different in different projects of my life. So as I just mentioned, I mean, I grew up with the religious communities. So my PhD was around trying to understand the element of the body with the ultra-Orthodox community and also with the Zionist Orthodox around sexuality, mostly LGBTQ. And just in general, how do they perceive women? It's a fascinating thing, so how much women pay the price again and again and again. So I try to offer tools that we can find new ways how to look on women relationships that we have. You know, I remember when one of the rabbis told me, we must separate our synagogue in gender between men and women. And he was very radical around that. Once I spoke with him and I said, do you know when you are going to change your mind? When you will see that there is so much gay people that this asexual, imaginative, you know, place that you want to have in the synagogue, because you are not going to have women, it will happen with men there. So let's redefine what do we want our synagogue to be, right? And to walk very slowly around that. So I did it there. I did it with Kids for Peace, a youth movement that I was one of the leaders. So with sitting there, Israelis and Palestinians, and what I did specifically, just because life chose me for that, I have religious background. So I invited mostly families with religious background to use their Islam, to use their Christianity and Judaism in order to create intimacy in places where you cannot have intimacy. So I will give you an example, very small example. Second Palestinian uprising, we call it in Arabic, the second Intifada, also in Hebrew, we use the Arabic term. And there is another bomb, another shooting. And I have a group of 50 team members, Muslim, Christian, and Jews, Palestinians and Israelis in Jerusalem. And we try to understand there is a war. There is like fight, you know, in Bethlehem, in Ramallah. And we try to understand, what do we do? What can we do? Now, I know we have different narratives, right? I mean, we disagree. And that point, I think that the IDF, the Israeli army, probably needs to act. and they believe that the Israeli army is now abusing Palestinians and killing uninvolved Palestinians.
Yeah, the stories are completely contradictory.
Right, exactly. No, totally different.
Meeting point, yeah.
What we did that afternoon, that we decided still to meet. Many people wanted to cancel the meeting. And I was also the director, but also I cannot force anyone. I invited that we all meet, and we all met, and we did one thing. We prayed together. Now, if you become a secular person or someone who looking from outside, you will say, what do you pray for? I mean, you pray probably for the opposite things. And I said, I will tell you again and again, it's irrelevant. The ability to pray, the words of prayers that, as you mentioned before, you say again and again and again every morning or every afternoon, and to be vulnerable next to each other. It's like the Israelis hold the tears of the Palestinians, people that they are working with for years. The Palestinians hold the prayers and the tears of the Israelis. You can say, but you disagree. I will say, this is how change happens.
It's the ultimate trust exercise.
100%. And the trust you need to work for. But at that moment, by using prayer, you're using something that forces all of us to be vulnerable. But also we know how to do very well.
And you know what you did there? You used action when the feelings were so
exactly
intense, but also contradictory.
100%.
The common action.
100%. And now I have the gift. In the past 6.5 years, I have the gift to work with the Israeli-American immigrants and to think like what kind of life you can imagine as an immigrant. I mean, there are so many challenges and questions as immigrants in America. And also to teach the next generation of rabbis. I'm very proud that I have enough school and places who want me to work with their future generation. And to ask them, I mean, listen, the family is not going to be the same family in New York. It's not even now. Non-monogamy changed Jewish life. I mean, you can say like, oh, divorce, divorce. The next question is not about divorce. It's about people who are going to be married, but going to have more than one partner. And, you know, as Jews, even Reform Jews, conservative Jews, the sacredness of what family is.
The family unit. Yeah.
Exactly. So I have the gift again and again and again. I feel that like I almost like, yeah, it's a real privilege and gift. And I'm honored to do that, to sit and to have the courage to sit with the questions before we have clear answers and to look at that.
I love that. I'm a big, big believer in questions. I want to ask you a question that I often ask myself. You were talking about gifts. I feel extremely, extremely privileged that I belong to a lot of places. I'm American and also Israeli. I grew up ultra-Orthodox, but also my entire career is in the secular world, no matter if it's Jewish or not. Most of my friends are not necessarily Orthodox or religious or Jewish or, you know, any of those definitions. I actually had a very emotional birthday party a few weeks ago, and I was really, speaking of gifts, there were around 30 people there. Some of them were non-binary, some of them were ultra-Orthodox men. You know, there's like, you see 30 people, it's not a large number, and there's so many different approaches to religion and to gender and to feminism and to activism. And it's not, we didn't sit and argue or anything. It wasn't about that. Everyone just like really enjoyed meeting each other if they didn't know each other before. So a lot of different kind of, I worked in publishing and I worked in marketing and I now work in tech for a few years. So there are a lot of different worlds. And I feel like that is a huge, huge gift. You get the cultural wealth of so many worlds. You get the spiritual wealth of so many worlds, but you also pay the price of then where do you actually belong? And you have to kind of create that for yourself.
100%. And
I want to ask you about that when it comes to you, but also one of the things that I No, you do. And I find like really, really fascinating when it comes to communities in America is working with Israeli American communities and working with Jewish American communities. And it should be so similar, right, when we think about it. But then also the belonging is so, it's like in the intricacies, it's in the nuances. But I would love to hear like how you relate to that and then how you bring it to your work or what do you see in your work that relates to that.
100%. Thank you so much for this question. The fact that I can live in, let's say, with different people, with different groups, doesn't mean that I don't have a set of beliefs. The only belief that I don't have is that I don't know anything about God. But let's be now mature, okay? Because I don't like the word God, it's too childish. I don't know what life is. I really don't know. But I'm so open to life, to relieved itself next to me, okay? And it's true about nature, which, by the way, I dedicated, honestly, 13, 14 years to create any relation with nature. I had zero because of the way how we grew up. Okay.
I relate to that so much. I can't. I have to tell you, I went today. I was like a little bit sad, and I went to the sun, and I took off my shoes and like just stood on the grass next to, in the Park HaLeumi in Ramat Gan, next to where I live, and I felt so good about myself because again, like it takes years and years to get anything, and then an old fisherman tells me, put on your shoes now. There are so many fishing hooks here. You're gonna die.
I
Like,
love
hey,
that. It's
thanks.
so beautiful. It's so beautiful, right? I mean, what danger is for you and like what does it mean to be in water? Yes. I want to go back because it's very important for me this point. The only thing that I don't know, and I say like I don't know as a mature person, is what is life about? I don't know. But I work really hard to let life reveal itself to me in different ways. It's also true about humanity. I don't understand humanity, but I'm saying now a sentence and I think I mean it. There is nothing human which is strange for me. There is nothing human that is strange for me. I have seen everything, I think, from the cruelty. And remember, I served at the military in the units that we identify the dead bodies. And I did in Palestine uprising. I saw the violence from both sides. I will not even go to sides, but I saw both the results. I saw the beauty in the most beautiful way that life, I think, can reveal itself. And I'm still sitting there and I'm saying, I don't know, but thank you for letting me to be in this mystery. Now, why it's important what I'm saying? This is the only thing that I don't know. But there are things that I know, and I'm very, in a way, radical. It doesn't mean that I'm going to bring it in dialogue, but I know who I am in some ways. I know that I have a story. I have the privilege, the gift that I was taught all these books that you as a woman were not allowed to open, which means that I have hundreds of ancestors who are walking with me, and I know them. I know how Rabbi Yochanan think, and I know how Reish Lakish think, and I know how Rabbi Meir think. And sometimes I need to tell to all these voices, guys, you're too much for me. So I want to go for a date with one of you. But when I am in a club and I feel like bored or something, I can invite my ancestors for the party. Okay, good. I know that I'm a feminist. And it's not a word that I'm saying. I am a radical feminist. I belong to the third wave of feminism. I think I see the privilege that I have as a cis man. I really care about women of my life and in general. And you cannot play with me. I'm a feminist and I'm proudly feminist. And then I know also what I don't want to be. And I take responsibility for that. For example, and I will say that it doesn't mean that I don't love people. I really love you guys, but I don't see myself as only Jewish. I want to have intimate, mystical relationship with life. If one day I need to go to pray in a mosque, I will go to pray with a mosque if I feel that I want to submit myself. For example, Jews, we don't submit ourselves to God, right? We don't believe in that. Fine. But sometimes I feel that I need to submit myself to God. I can go. There are 10 minutes from my home. There is an amazing mosque. I learned for years in Kids for Peace to learn to pray in Arabic. I know how Muslims feel. I said before, I go to Catholic monasteries. My wife, she grew up Buddhist. I had the huge privilege to live with a Buddhist who went in summer camps. When you went to, I don't know, to your religious Orthodox summer camp, she went to witch camps.
Amazing.
She know magic. She speaks about goddess. Many of my friends are deeply connected to the goddess and to femininity. Now I want to say one more thing about myself, which is important. I choose to build in the capitalism of America today, to choose with friends, with people, some of them I didn't know, to build an intentional community. I'm speaking now from a house where I live with 9 people, and don't ask me if they are Jewish or not, because it's irrelevant, but they are gorgeous humans who choose to live together. And believe me, this is a half-time job because it's like marriage. It's like, right? It's a Hasidic marriage because you married and you don't know to whom you married, but you know that you are going to do the work. So I'm really surrounded among myself with people who want me to be myself. It's very important. You spoke about your 30 friends who came to the party. I have, I don't know if I have 30, but I have people who are dedicated and they care about my voice. Everyone in this house, every Friday night, we do Shabbat. And again, don't ask me if they're Jewish or not. But when we sing Shalom Aleichem, when we go and someone wants to say like, ah, I had a good day, they will say Baruch Hashem, right? They will say Baruch, it means like bless God. Now, I think half of them are atheists, for sure not Jewish, but they understand that Yekir way of being gratitude to life is to say Baruch Hashem. Like to say, bless God. Now, to what God? Irrelevant, right? It's irrelevant.
It's irrelevant. It just becomes an expression of your feeling.
But it's expression of love and intimacy. It's expression of love and intimacy. Then, from that core, I have the energy to go out and to be with the complexity. I don't live in my daily, in my home, I don't live so much the complexity. I have a place to rest. And it's very important for me because we are speaking about the relationship between home and work. I want to encourage anyone who listens to this dialogue. Please, if you want to change anything outside, you must have a core and growing core in your life so you can do your work. At the end of the day, changing outside is to deal with trauma. And at home, it's not that people here do not have trauma, but we learn how to hold our traumas and how to support the traumas. And also how to say to some trauma, I don't know yet how to live with you, so I can invite you as a guest to my home, but I'm not going to have, for example, if someone would grow up with a huge mental illness or suffering, I don't know yet how to live with them, right? So you need to know your no's in order to say your yes. So this is my way how I do change.
That's amazing. And then you go into the world.
And then I go to the world. And when I go to the world, I don't care about anything other than the people who are next to me and to listen to them and to be with them. So, you know, it's a joke sometimes inside myself, of course. The people who were the most anti-Kids for Peace when I was in Israel, they told me, you are shameful for Israel. You are a Palestinian lover who hates your people, etc., etc. Some of them, they are now the people who give money to the organization where I work because they immigrated to America. They're Israelis, maybe very right-wing Israelis, but they are living in America. And I am on charge to create the leadership for their community. Now they can look at me and says like, well, wait, but it was the same Yakir who were like the Palestinian lover who hate Israelis and Jews, right? But now I am with them. Now, it doesn't mean that I don't care about Palestinians. Of course I care. But it's not the question, because my role now is not about Palestine. My role now is to take an immigrant community who is suffering now in America. Something happened in this war with huge increasing of anti-Semitism and hate towards Israel, and to find language to that, to find language for the trauma, to find a narrative that can hold their Zionist story, their love to America, to love the contradiction, to learn to deal with their kids who don't want to speak Hebrew, but also they don't want to speak Israeli. They want to speak American, right? Like immigrants, first generation, when you grow up here. So I have the gift to be with them and to think and to build a system that will hold them. And I'm so thankful that they trust me.
It's amazing. And, you know, in my eyes, it's all the same, because it's about the people, and it's about holding their needs and their suffering, but also the opportunity and the beauty that can be gained, and the pain, right? And pain is pain. Humans are humans. That's part. I don't know if you're familiar. You probably are, because we have a lot of friends in common with the Smola Emuni, the faithful left in Israel.
Yeah.
They have their conference next week. Yes. Probably already happened by the time the episode will be out. And for me, in the last year, I think their first conference was a year ago. It's one of the movements that's giving me the most hope. Last year, I couldn't make it to the event. I left my house 12 years in the same week.
Wow.
But even just the existence of these people and these events, and the fact that there are people there, yes, they call themselves the faithful left, but there's such a wide spectrum of faith and of left and political views. I think especially now with the war, that kind of makes people question where they are. And some people are going much more left, some people are going more to the center. But just having and holding that conversation, the capacity for looking at human pain and good deeds of humans and all of that is so important, and more than ever now.
100%. You know, one of the things in a lecture that I heard the head of the Jewish Federation of America, of North America, Eric, and he shared that he took last May, he took a group of his team to Israel, and they spent exactly the day of the 2 days. One is a memorial day for the soldiers, and then, of course, at night, because Judaism starts at night, so as the sunset comes, there is a shift from the memorial day to the independent day of Israel, right? Now, in America, it's very different. It's happening in two different times of the year.
Also, in America, Memorial Day, if you don't have a loved one who served, it's so different.
Exactly. So the Memorial Day, it's exactly as you said. The Memorial Day is like you do barbecue and you do shopping, right? There is discount. But in Israel, there is something that everyone grieved together. And then, right, think about it. Now, because everyone in Israel served in the military, it means that unlike in America, that specific sections with less privilege, let's be honest, they are the one who joined the military. In Israel, it's different. It's like the person who teach our little kids in the kindergarten, they can be an officer in the military, right?
Yeah. And it's so apparent now in the war, because everyone is like doing their reserve duty.
Exactly. So because of that, there's also the grieving happening in every city, in every village, in every kibbutz in Israel.
And it's everywhere. You can't open the radio. Like, it's all sad songs. And it's like just a very somber, solemn feeling that even if you just go about your day, you can't escape it. It's like very, very heavy, like kind of all-encompassing feeling.
Exactly. And then what happened that when the sunset come, there is a shift. And then you start celebrating from this grieving the Independent Day of Israel, right? Now, it's unbelievable. You just cried for a day. Like, you really cried. I mean, we know that. We know the feeling. You are there. you cry, you listen to the songs, and you are like, again, and another story, and another story. And this year is going to be horrible with the amount of everything. And then you need to celebrate. Now, why it's important, why I bring it? Because I think there is something very unique about Israel, that we learn that independence and freedom doesn't happen just because you deserve that. Yes, we all deserve it. We all have the image of God, dignity, you name it.
It doesn't exist in a vacuum. Yeah.
Exactly. So you need to fight for that, and you need to grieve for that. And I think that when you have such a complex society, it's easier to be in the middle of a war that many Israelis think that this is a just war now with Gaza, and still to wish for peace, and still to wish for a different future, because there is something about the cultures that hold this complexity. And I think what is important for me in this dialogue around that is to take these examples and to translate, and I do quotation, to different tradition, to different cultures. So for example, many times when people, even in my community, they ask me, Yekir, we just like dealing with specific question, a different, very painful thing, right? I mean, there is so much in America to deal with. How you can be so much into the shit and into the pain and still be so hopeful? And I'm saying, you know, this is a gift that I got from Israel. Let's try to do it also at home. But it means that we need also to grieve together. We need to be vulnerable and to cry.
You can't run away from it.
Exactly, yes.
Because then you don't get the hope either.
100%, exactly. So you don't have the hope if you don't have the vulnerability together. And I think that something that America now a little bit scares me, and I think that the Israeli-American we can bring, at least for the Jewish community, is that today the Jewish community is so strong and so powerful that people who are Republicans and people who are Democrats, people of Bernie Sanders, let's say, and the people of Trump, we never talk together. We don't go to the same synagogue anymore, right?
Oh, we have the echo chambers.
And I think there is something about the Israeli-American, just because we are immigrants, that we are all together, and because we are Israelis, we are forcing different leaders to meet and to work together. And it's so needed, because life is so much more complex than being right.
Totally. Yekir, we're reaching the end of the episode. I feel like we mentioned so many powerful questions, but still I want to ask you if there's one powerful question you want to share with us that you asked yourself or others.
Wow, there are many questions that I'm asking myself these days. But I think that, I mean, again, we are bringing our life stories. So I came now to a new circle of life around my masculinity, because I became a father. And I think there is something about fatherhood, about manhood, that your agency when it comes to pregnancy, I needed to grieve the fact that I cannot be pregnant, which is didn't make sense for me. That Anika Laila Ahuva, she is the one who is getting pregnant. And then she gave birth. I had the gift to really hold as a midwife. She let me from the moment that the crown of the head came out, she gave me to be with her.
Wow.
So my hands were like without gloves, with everything, touch this life that's happening. And now to be a father, you know, I cannot give the milk. I mean, I can give a bottle. The child doesn't want a bottle. He wants the somatic body. And I also, I'm very somatic, means I see the world with touch. This is my language. Words I'm not so good at. So I'm much more with touch. So I think that there are a lot of questions around masculinity and about how much gender is a bitch, like how much it's forced me and doesn't let me to be what I wish to be, and to submit myself to this journey and to be there with this complexity. This is a big question that I'm holding. What does it mean? Like, I didn't want to be a father, okay? And here come the faith, okay? I want to give an example of faith in a secular world. I didn't want to be a father. I don't think it's not for me. I still will say that. Like, for Yekir, it's not. And I think it's totally okay. And I so in love with my primary partner, with my wife, with Anika, that and Annika needed to be a mother. There is no question she should be a mother. So for me, this is where faith comes from. It's like, I so believe in the power of life, and I so believe in my love towards Annika and that she gave me the gift to love her, that I choose to be a father in order to observe and to be a partner around this miracle that she's going to do. And she is powerful. She is a mother in 100. It's like, I'm feeling that I'm watching National Geography movie. And it's fascinating. So these are the questions that I'm now, and I can't wait to see how it's going to evolve. I just feel so, so lucky.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's amazing how much we learn about ourselves and the world through this parenthood journey. It never ceases to amaze me. My son is 17, and still every day, every hour, you learn something.
Thank you. Thank you for this dialogue.
Yakir, thank you so much for being here. It was amazing, a revelation. I loved our conversation, and I hope our listeners will take something valuable from it. I know that they will. And I want to congratulate you again on your baby and
you.
On doing all the important work that you do.
I really thank you so much. And any dialogues that come, any questions, I'm really, really available. It's very important for me. You know, there is a state of mind in America is to be busy. Always say I'm not busy. I don't have this state of mind. So any dialogues that people need or we can help, we are here. We are what we say in Hebrew, shluchei tzibur. We are, like, at the end of the day, the servants of the people. So I am very humble and honored that life gave me the gift to serve as a servant for the people. Thank you so much.
How can people reach you?
By email, you can put it, Facebook, and some of the technicality. Or just say, grab me on the street and says, like, I want coffee. Come to Philly.
We'll give your address in the show notes.
100%.